Good morning, church. In case you have look a little confused, I am not Dion. We do look a lot alike. There's a couple of ways to tell us apart. He's a little taller than I am. And if we're not standing next to each other and you don't remember that, he usually wears a watch. I almost never do. So you should be good to go on that going forward. So in case you're wondering, I'm David. I'll be playing the part of your preacher this morning. I don't know all the details of where Dion is at exactly. I think he's in Michigan right now. So, you know, when he asked me about doing this a few weeks ago, I think he thought I wouldn't think this through. And he's right. I mean, he's like, hey, will you do it? And then we're going to talk about Noah. That's the next one. And I'm like, sure. Yeah, I know the story of Noah, where I'm going to be here. That's fine. What could possibly go wrong? I know this story, right? And so I started thinking, I'll just draw on all the sermons I've heard about Noah over the last 50 years. Yeah, 50 years. The first few years, really, I don't remember the sermons. But I've been to church a lot. I've heard over 3,000 sermons. Countless small group Bible studies and Bible classes and lectures. And I don't remember one about Noah. Have y'all, does that resonate with anybody? Have you heard a lot of sermons? Since second grade, maybe? No one has taught me about Noah. And so I was like, oh, wow, I got to learn some stuff. And really, that's something I got to dig into this. The weird thing is, I feel like I know this story so well, even though that's true. I haven't heard sermons or lessons on it in decades. Have you heard about the lullaby effect? I know there's a Bible teacher, too, that used this phrase. It's when you hear something or you read something and it's so familiar, you're casual about it, and it's like, yeah, I get it. And you miss the details because you have in your mind what the story is so closely that that's what you see. And I think there may not be a story in the Bible that has more of this lullaby effect for me than the story of Noah. I've heard it. I don't even remember learning it. I've always known it. And on top of that, it's a children's story. So I get it. Yeah, animals, big boat, flood, rainbow. Got it. But the reality is, in this week and a half, 2 weeks, I have spent more time studying these three chapters than I have in my entire life. And I've actually been blown away about how much I've missed. I mean, I'm only here for a few minutes. We should do sermon series just on Noah. I think we could spend a while on it. So that's something that Dion can do later. I was so surprised at how integral this story is to the entire narrative of the Bible. And the downside is, I'm only going to share with you maybe a tenth of what I've found. And I missed so many other things because I just didn't have time. I'm like, wow, that's a great resource. Not going to talk about that. So there is so much here. And if it seems a little lack of cohesion, first of all, that's me. And second, there's just so much. The biggest challenge of this sermon was, how do I cull out all the great stuff that I've seen in just a few minutes? So I'm just going to give you a few big ideas that really jumped out at me, and there's a few. And the first thing I'm going to say is a little controversial, and it might get me in trouble with some of you, and so I'm going to get that out of the way right now. If you have complaints about the sermon, these are your instructions right here. You can So just don't forget that. That's on the website. I just made it easier for you. Just go right there. He likes it. It doesn't have to be just complaints about the sermon. It could be any complaint. Just send it his way. In looking for material about Noah's Ark, you know, the first thing that I looked online, I Google it, and I came up with this wealth of information. That's my research material for the sermon. This is it. This story is at the center of like everything we do for kids, it seems, in our culture. And what I came to realize is we are sick. This is the most terrible story to tell little children. Are there any in here? I hope they've all, they're all in children's church. I'm going to feel bad if they're doing, they said they weren't going to do Noah's Ark today, which I'm glad. But don't tell them if it's, but this is a terrible story. Everybody dies. Everybody just about, there's like less than a tenth of a fraction of a percent live. Everybody else dies. I mean, even the little puppy dogs and the little kittens and the bunny rabbits. I mean, this is a terrible, you don't want to tell the story to children. I don't. But this is what we do. So I'm just going to say, maybe we should rethink that. Just maybe. Maybe we shouldn't use this story in our children's curriculum. I don't think we're doing that here, but I'm just going to throw that out there as a thought to go on. Again, if you have complaints about that, your instructions are here. So as we move into the text, I'll tell you about the thing that hit me the most, and it is the miracle of this book. This study has highlighted to me again that this is written in such a way that the most basic understanding can be gained of God, of humanity, of creation, and how we all relate to each other in just a few minutes, really a couple of hours at most. And yet, at the same time, you can spend a lifetime studying this text, unlocking its deeper meanings, and there's a mystery that's revealed as you devote yourself to its study. This if you meditate on the word and study it with diligence and you ponder it from many angles, you will continue to draw out more and more. And there's a richness that will come to your from the text that will never cease to surprise you, and it will stretch you, it will strengthen your faith and your understanding of God. His word is meant to be understood by the smallest of children. And it is. And it is a mystery that continually reveals itself to our greatest scholars. There's truly no other work like it. And we're going to keep coming back to things that led me to that big idea, that this is such a remarkable story. The story of Noah, and this I didn't know until very recently, it is woven into the tapestry of the Bible in such a way that it calls back everything that occurred before, and it introduces everything that comes after. It sets the stage for the entire story. So let's get to it. If you turn to Genesis 6 in your Bibles, there's the first four verses of Genesis 6. Wow. This is some cryptic stuff here. There's this stuff about the sons of God and the daughters of men, and then there's this notion about how the age of humanity is limited to 120 years, and then the Nephilim are introduced and the mighty men of old, and we're not going to talk about any of that. that's for the sermon series that comes later. That was an amazing little path that I went down. But I'm going to read a lot of the rest of the text, but I'm going to skip some things. So just try to follow along or just listen. Starting in verse 5. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. The New American Standard Version there says he was deeply grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race that I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I've made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God, and Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. This is the introduction to our children's story. When we think about the wrath of God, particularly in the Old Testament, I don't know about you, but this was often a story that I thought of. I mean, what more wrathful, judgmental notion can we come up with than the great flood that kills 99.9% of everything on the earth? So in what I read, did you notice the language of wrath and anger? Did you hear wrath and anger? It's not there. I thought it was there. It's not there. There's no mention of anger or wrath at all in these chapters. The text says his heart was deeply troubled, or as I read another version, he was deeply grieved in his heart. This is our next big idea that I got. This is not the story about a judgmental, destructive God full of wrath. It's about a brokenhearted, grief-stricken one. It's not righteous destruction born out of anger. It's a sovereign God who gives humanity over to the destruction that they had already chosen for themselves. The earth was filled with violence. I'm not sure I can imagine that. But I get this sense that the violence that is so concerning to me and to all of us in our world today doesn't even hold a candle to what was going on back then. Every inclination of the thoughts of man was only evil all the time. I know the author is using hyperbole there. I know that. But I don't think anyone could objectively look at the world today and even come close to uttering that phrase about the world. I don't know how bad it could be. It must have been our worst nightmares. So as we dig into that a little more, I want to look at Genesis 6:13 just a little closer. And what I want to do is pull it up in three different translations in English, because it'll help, I think, to see something that's in the Hebrew. And I'm not trying to criticize these translations at all. I mean, I put the NIV and the ESV first because those are the two that I use the most. And I'm going to continue to use them the most. They're the ones that I, for whatever reason, I've chosen them. I really like those two translations. And they're the first two I go to. But there's value in looking at other ones because we are dealing with something that was translated. And so the translators had to make choices. And I mean, we do that too as readers. If I read something and you read something, even standing right next to one another, the same words, we'll come up with a different idea sometimes. And that's definitely true here. But do you see the difference in the NASB at the bottom? The end of all flesh has come before me. That's the literal rendering of the Hebrew. The sense I get from that is not that, I mean, the ESV says, I have determined. It's as if God said it's done. But the way that the NASB reads, it's more like God's recognizing that it has already happened. The end of all flesh is apparent to me. And so I'm going to wash it away. I don't know if you're familiar with the Bible Project at all. You know, the main voice you hear, it's a guy, his name is Tim Mackey. He's a great teacher. If you get a chance to listen to any of his material, you should. This is a quote from him. The flood is both God's judgment and his mercy. As we work through the story, we see that God is responding to the outcry of violence and rebellion throughout the land. The just creator of the world is pained in his heart over the prevalence of bloodshed and injustice. Human beings are on a destructive course, threatening not only all of humanity, but all of creation. With the flood, God mercifully addresses the evil in the world and justly brings the course of destruction to its conclusion. Another author referred to this as a severe mercy. And that was something that I just like sat on for a couple of days. What a terrible thought. As a parent, you can kind of get a little bit of a sense, certainly not to this degree, about how sometimes you have to let your child experience something that's unpleasant that maybe you could stop, but it's for the best interest of the child to go through this severe time. Let's get back to the Bible and just try to keep up. I am going to skip some things here, getting back into verse 14. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. And then the text goes on to describe some more dimensions and some details. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, in which is the breath of life under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die, but I will establish my covenant with you. And you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Then there's more about the animals and the details here. Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. Then the Lord said to Noah, go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Take with you seven pairs of all clean animals. So there's more about the animals. He kind of does a little detail addition with the clean animals. And in 7 days, I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights. And every living thing that I've made, I will blot out from the face of the ground. And Noah did all the Lord had commanded him. After 7 days, the waters of the flood came upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, he gets real specific there, doesn't he? On that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of heaven were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife, and the three wives of his sons with them, entered the ark, they and every beast according to its kind. More details. They went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh, in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in, and as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. And all flesh that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind, everything on dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life, died. He blotted out everything that was on the face of the ground, man and animals, and creeping things and birds of heaven. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those who were with him in the ark, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. I don't know if a story that we've already talked about is coming into your mind. We'll keep coming back to that. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heavens were closed. The rain from the heavens was restrained, and the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the waters had abated. And in the seventh month of the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. Then there's a section about birds, and we're going to skip that. In 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark, looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Then God said to Noah, go out from the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you, bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with them, every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves, everything. There's a lot of repetition here. Are you hearkening back to another story, though? Noah built an altar to the Lord, took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man. For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. So the curse from Genesis 3 is lifted. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, the blood. And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning from every beast. I will require it, and from man. And from his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Let me skip down a little. Then you be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. Almost finished here. And then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring with you, after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is a sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh on the earth. So throughout that reading, I mean, I called out a few things. I hope you were catching the connection that's there with creation. In the simplest of terms, for those of us today in the 21st century, God did a reboot of creation. If you look at a story, and I'm going to have a hard time with the mic in my hand maybe, but in the beginning, the earth was a watery depth, and the Spirit of God moved across it, right? And the word for spirit there is ruach. And in Hebrew, if you see the word spirit or wind or breath, it's the same word, ruach. The ruach of God moved on the waters. Then God illuminated his creation and he separated the water above and below. And then he had dry land appear and life. And he saw that it was very good. In Genesis 6:5, and then in 6:11, God saw the great evil on the earth. God saw that the earth was corrupt and filled with violence. And he unseparated the waters above and below. And the dry ground disappeared and the life with it. The sky was dark. We have to infer that. It doesn't say that, but it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. It was dark. And then the last verse there, the wind, God sent a wind across the earth and the waters. God sent a ruach across the earth and the water. That's the inflection point. After that, the waters separated again. The dry ground appears. Life emerges. And throughout it all, you hear, be fruitful and multiply. You hear this repetitive statement of, and God said, and God said, and God said. You can't read this text without being brought back to creation. And when you do that, you can begin to see the depth of the grief that God is feeling here. And you also see the mercy that he's granting. Now I want to focus on the ark itself. So if you look at the picture of it, this is not quite what we think of the ark, right? But bear with me a little bit. We do think of a boat, right? And it's always got this keel. You know what a keel is? The beam, the front to the back and the bottom, from the bow to the stern. That's what we think of. But if you read the text, there's no mention of a keel. There's no mention of curves or angles or corners of any kind. So I'm not saying Noah didn't do that. He could have. Maybe he did design something like this. But if you just look at the simple reading of the text, it's not really a boat. It looks more like that. In the simplest of terms, it's a rectangle. It's a giant box. So there's a scholar who studied this. He spent a lot of time on this, Michael Morales, and I'll get the quote from him. While popular depictions of the ark often mislead us into viewing it as a boat, the vessel, having no sails, no rudder, no oarsman, was no boat, and Noah was no captain, steering his own fate. Indeed, that the ark was completely given over to the sovereign guidance of God seems to be the primary emphasis of the narrative. The instruction to build the ark in Genesis 6 utilizes three times as many verses than it does for the actual flood itself, demonstrating that the emphasis on the ark itself as a means of deliverance. That's the point of the text. We'll talk more about that. There are some other words I want to dig into a bit. The word ark itself, I don't know about you, I don't use that word very often in my everyday language, the word ark. It's an old English term, but the Hebrew here is tevah. It is not a Hebrew word, actually. It's an Egyptian word. It's a borrowed word. So that's not super uncommon in Hebrew. I mean, it's really common in English. We have thousands of borrowed words, right? Thousands of them. But this word tevah, or ark, it means in Egyptian a chest or a box, like a sacred chest. And the usage was, it's a box that you would put an idol in a temple or a shrine. So bear with me a little bit. But it had another meaning too, by the way. It was coffin. It could be a coffin. I'm betting Noah thought, I hope God's not intending that to be the definition for this ark. I mean, but anyway, this Jewish scholar did exhaustive research on these borrowed Egyptian words in the Pentateuch. And what he said is, these chests generally had the form of a divine shrine, and they served as the housing for an image of God. In their case, an idol. And then these little boxes would be dedicated, and then sometimes they had the form of a longish chest with a door in them, where you could put the idol in, the image of God. Sound familiar? The chest would often, for festivals, they would be put on a wooden platform and floated down the Nile River from one temple town to another. So what the Egyptians did for an idol, here God, Yahweh, the God of Israel, preserves his image in the ark in a tevah. There's surely some tie in there, right? So it's a sacred box that you put the image of God in. It's only used in two places in the Bible. It's here in the story of Noah. The other one is the story of Moses. Any guesses where that is? It's the basket. So when When Pharaoh decreed that all the baby boys should be thrown into the flooding waters of the Nile, we have a figure who thinks he's God decreeing the destruction of these people he doesn't like by throwing them in the water. His mother makes an ark and puts Moses in it. Not Noah, Moses. Moses in it. So if you've heard that joke about the ark and you Moses, Moses had an ark that he was put in. So anyway, that's it. Same word, tevah. And I don't know why other English, most English translations don't, in Exodus 2, they translated basket, not ark. I'm not really sure why, but that's what the word is in Hebrew. Interestingly, the word for, that you were probably thinking of ark or the covenant, not tevah. That word is a word called aron. Keep bearing with me for a minute. I know it's weird, but even though it's a different Hebrew word, there are some choices, word choices around its construction and design and its usage that link the two together. And there's a reason that when the Hebrew is translated into English in almost every single translation from the King James to the NIV, the ESV, today, almost everyone translates Aron as Ark also, the Ark of the Covenant. We'll come back to that in a second. Next word, gopher. Gopher wood. We don't really know what that is. We think it's a type of tree. And I'm only telling you about that because the next word I want to tell you about. The next word I'll tell you about is pitch. Pitch, right? So it's actually in the English, it's we want to pitch it with pitch. Right? That's what Noah does. He pitches it with pitch. The word there is kofar. Kofarize it with kofar. Make it with gopher, pitch it with kofar. It's like Dr. Seuss. Why isn't that in the children's story? Make it out of wood of gopher, then you pitch it with the gopher. But anyway, we'll stay away from that one. That kind of wordplay is again, it's one of the things you just see constantly through the Bible. And it's almost as if there's this super intelligent, super creative mind who's kind of guiding the whole thing along, maybe. One of the things that the author does to link these three arcs together is kofar. Because in Moses' basket, his mother makes it by pitching it with pitch and tar. She kofarizes it with kofar and tar. And then when the Ark of the Covenant is built, it's overlaid with gold. That's not kofar, by the way. That's overlaid. That's a different word. And it's not pitch that they do it with. It's gold. Different. But there's a nuance here. The word kofar is a homonym. You remember what homonyms are? Homonym, two words, spelled the same, totally different words. Think of the word LEAD in English. The elders lead our church, LEAD. It was Professor Plum in the library with the lead pipe, LEAD. Same spelling, two completely different words. Pitch itself is a homonym. Throwing a ball is a pitch. And then there's the stuff you seal things with. So the homonym here is kofar. The other use of kofar is not throwing a ball. They didn't do that then. They weren't playing baseball. But in Exodus 25, there's a covering for the Ark of the Covenant. It's usually translated as either the mercy seat or the atonement cover. The Hebrew word there is kofar. Same exact spelling, same exact sound. And on the Day of Atonement, the blood of the sacrifice is sprinkled on the mercy seat, on the kofar, to forgive the people of their sins. So again, we're using this idea of a sacred box or chest in a holy shrine where God resides. In this case, in the tabernacle, on the Ark of the Covenant, there's no idol or image of God. That's forbidden. Instead, it is God himself who manifests himself on the Ark of the Covenant, on the kofar. And that's why, in all three cases, You see this translated as ark. A giant wooden boat, a small basket, a sacred golden box. The ark, whether it's a tevah or an aron, made with kofar or with a kofar, is a means of deliverance and salvation. And that is the emphasis of the ark. The deliverance, much more than the flood. The last big idea I have for you is this. There are three key themes that are introduced here that are central to everything in our faith throughout the rest of the Bible. And I would say if you don't understand these three things, you're going to have a real difficult time with our faith in its whole. The first one, did you notice who was called out as righteous? Noah. Did you notice who was not called out as righteous? The other seven people in the boat. Now, maybe they were or maybe they weren't, but the sense that we get is that through the righteous one, many are saved. We're going to see that idea again, aren't we? That notion is introduced here. The second one. Did you catch what God says to Noah in 7:1? I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. He says that right after it says Noah did everything God commanded. I don't know if that reminds you of anybody. I was thinking Abraham. Wow, it was credited to him as righteousness. The righteous have life through faith, and this faith is evidenced through their obedience. That will become a model for how people are supposed to respond to God from this point until now. The last one is the covenant between God and humanity. This is where the notion of a covenant is first introduced. In the garden, there was no covenant. In the garden, God gave minimal directions and let men do what they wanted. And now, through brokenness, we're going to change the relationship a little bit. We're going to introduce a covenant. We're going to talk about what that means. And it's generally an agreement where I agree to do some things and you agree to do some things and we write them down. And then there's some consequences if I fail to do what I said, and there's consequences if you fail to do what you said. That's usually what a covenant is. But that's not the way a covenant works here. What's the requirement for Noah and the descendants of the earth? There isn't one. In this case, as it is with most, not all, of the covenants that God enters into with man, there is no obligation for man. There is only one for God. Even if man and humanity goes back to this level of evil, God will not do this again. He gives up his right for this type of punishing leverage. God makes himself solely responsible for the terms of the covenant. Covenants will define the relationship between God and his people from this point forward until Jesus comes along and brings a new covenant. So if you haven't chosen life through faith in this Jesus, the one righteous man through whom all can be saved, if you haven't chosen to accept the new covenant that he offers, this is the time. You can come forward now. If there's something on your heart that you want to talk with us about, if you want to pray with us, please come forward now as we stand and sing.